Hello and welcome to the latest SearchWindDevelopment.com podcast. I am your host, site editor Brian Eastwood. Today I am joined by Mario Hewart and Daniel Pravat. Both Mario and Daniel are senior development engineers at Microsoft, and they are also co-authors of a book called Advanced Windows Debugging, which was recently published by Addison Wesley as part of its Microsoft Technology series. Hello, Mario and Daniel.
Hi, Brian.
Oh, hi, Brian.
Hi. Okay, so today we're going to be chatting with them about their book and also a little bit about some of the general concepts that surround Windows debugging. So, gentlemen, are you guys ready?
We're ready.
Okay, sounds good. So my first question is, Addison Wesley, on the page for your book, describes it as the first in-depth, real-world insider's guide to powerful Windows debugging. What made you guys decide to devote an entire book to the topic of debugging?
So one of the key reasons for this is we want to sort of bridge a gap that exists in the marketplace today. There's a ton of really great books out there about, you know, how to write perfect code, and very few books about how to actually debug code when it's not working properly.
Ah, okay.
And so that was one of the primary things. The books that are out there are actually very good debugging books as well, but they're touching at a bit higher level than we are. It's usually mostly focused on source level debugging, whereas we use or describe tools like the Windows debugging package. They're far more low level and allows you to investigate the system in more depth.
Oh, cool.
And there is one more interesting aspect of the whole debugging experience. There is a lot of tribal knowledge that is transferred from person to person, from developer to developer. There is not enough written information about how to solve real problems in the world. There is a wealth of tools available from Microsoft, and most of the developers out there are not aware of them. And I think in our book we managed to use all of them and explain them to people.
So it's kind of like a gathering of all of the different sort of practices that, you know, people have been sort of adopting sort of on their own individually. It's a nice collection of all that.
Exactly. We are trying to show all the tribal knowledge with the associated set of tools for public consumption.
Oh, cool.
In our experience, we are also using debuggers not only to debug the code, but to do sort of reverse engineering, you can say.
Oh, okay.
When you are joining, for example, a new group, they already have a legacy product. They have a lot of code available. You need to really understand how to debug that code, how that code works. You need to, and the debuggers are a great tool to be able to inspect the code in its dynamic form.
Ah, interesting.
You know, a regular source editor will fail to really explain you how the code really works when a specific counter is incremented. You need to see the application running.
Oh, okay.
Right. Okay.
That sounds good. I guess that sort of what sort of follows from that is how, in your sort of development process, can you ensure that you're debugging through every stage of the development life cycle? How do you, you know, sort of ingrain in your mind the need to do that?
So I think the key there is that it really does have to be sort of built into the process and schedule as well.
Yeah.
A great example of something that you can do, one of the tools that we talk about, which is called UMDH, allows you to track down memory leaks, right? It's a very, very common problem in when you develop. And educating engineers on what tools are available and how to use them as part of your everyday job. For example, anytime you change a piece of code and you want to check it into the source tree, you need to run UMDH, for example, or whatever is applicable for your scenario to catch some of these problems. If you do that during the development process, it's going to save you an enormous amount of money in the long run.
Oh, yeah.
Envision checking in a piece of code, it has a small memory leak, it's out on the server somewhere on the customer site, and it leaks very little memory, you know, on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Now, after a week, the server explodes because it ran out of memory, and now what do you do, right? It's a very, very expensive proposition to track that down on site.
Exactly.
So integrating these tools into the development process is key and can save a lot of money.
Yeah.
That is one more one aspect of fixing the problem as soon as possible. The cost grows exponential from the time you make the check-in until the bug is discovered on the customer side.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, to fix a bug in my my build environment will take me 1 minute. To fix it on the customer environment will require perhaps thousands of dollars to create patches, to make sure the patch is installable, is working fine, and will always work on the customer side, and it's hard.
Yeah, so I guess when in doubt, think of that bottom line.
Yeah. I'll add something on debugging on development lifecycle.
Mm-hmm.
I think when a developer is writing code, he's doing a lot of debugging by tracing the code, like he's watching the source codes and is watching the variables change in time. But there is another type of debugging that is done after the application was already deployed in a test system or in a stress lab, and in that moment you need to have access to good symbols, you need to have the entire procedures to be able to perform debugging. And the same requirements are also true after you are deploying the application in the wild and you want to integrate, for example, with Windows Error Reporting. You still need to have to maintain all the symbols, you need to have all the procedures in place.
Ah. All right, that's good to know. I was sort of building on that. You had mentioned some of the good, you know, best practices for writing your code so that, you know, it's you're debugging as you go and you're sort of constantly verifying it as you go. But one of the things you sort of talk about a bit in your book is how to debug code that wasn't really written, like with debugging in mind. What do you do with that sort of code? What are some of the ways that you can kind of work with code that wasn't really written to address debugging?
Yeah, that's sort of the holy grail of debugging questions, but how to debug tough code. I think one of the key things is to understand, you know, not just your own application fully, but also understand all the dependencies, like all the dependent components that you have.
Oh, okay.
Example of that is, say you write some app that uses DCOM or RPC, and, you know, it makes a connection to a remote server, and during one test case, the connection just hangs, right? A lot of times people get a little bit nervous stepping outside the boundaries of their own application and investigating, you know, DCOM or RPC. And so I think doing that is a very, very key thing to do.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'll add that developers talking about understanding the components, they really need to understand, not necessarily in the details, how each component or infrastructure works, but they must be able to clearly identify the transition points from one component to another.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, to be able to use the debugger tools to just set some hooks on the transition points and really watch the flow of information going through the transition points. And in the same way, like electronic engineers are doing when they are using a oscilloscope to watch to see if the signal in a specific spot is right. So even if you don't understand the specific component in details, you need to understand what's happening at the transition boundaries.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so it's sort of a matter of kind of focusing on the areas that you know might bring up some concerns.
Yeah, and I'd also like to add another thing, which is being able to correctly identify the potential problem you're looking at. That might seem like an obvious thing, but it can sometimes lead you down false paths. You know, a good example of this is like quality assurance comes and says, we found that your application is leaking a little bit of memory. And it's an application that you don't necessarily own, right? And you can look at it and you can immediately start running all these leak tools or do various other things, and you're already assuming that there is a leak, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so on. It could very well be that the application is caching something temporarily, or doing some other things, and memory consumption will drop back down again. So really, like, focusing on identifying what problem you're seeing is crucial as well.
Yeah. It's kind of like when I sometimes will start my car and I'm parked on a hill and I'll make it about half a mile before I realize my e-brake is still up. Realizing, oh, that's the problem. Okay.
Yep.
Didn't think of that. I'd also noticed that you spend a little bit of time in your book sort of talking about debugging for Windows Vista and for 64-bit kind of stuff. What sort of additional challenges does that present that developers may not have been familiar with up till now?
I'll start on that.
Okay.
One of the biggest challenges is obviously the processor architecture. There is a new type of processor. It's very common, but people are not used to see the code, unassembled code for that processor. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things have changed in this new architecture. So first we have, there is a different calling convention for applications built for that processor.
Okay.
There are different structure types. Most of them are just doubled in size. You know, whatever was 8 bits before, 8 bytes, right now is 16 bytes. Whatever was 4 byte pointer, right now is 8 byte pointer. And there is some change there. There is a different calling convention. There is the set of instruction sets is almost similar with the previous processor, but you still need to understand small details, how exactly is the transition from a regular 32-bit to 64-bit done. Also, Windows Vista 64 and also Windows XP 64 is fully compatible with all 32-bit applications. They are running in what is called Windows on Windows environment.
Oh, okay.
And that creates a new set of problems, because you have transition points between that WoW environment and the native environment. There is in Vista, not necessarily related to 64-bit, is a new security model, and you need to really understand all the details of that security model to be able to not to have problems even while you are debugging.
Okay.
We discover some issues when we are starting the debugging tools. You know, something we expect to work, it was not working from the beginning, and we need to understand how the security changes affect the debugger tools. There is also the concept of protected processes in Vista that they are usually used for media type applications.
Oh, okay.
And they are coming with their own set of challenges, and people willing to debug and having to debug that kind of process, they need to understand what is behind that protected processes. There is a new communication mechanism in Vista that replaces the old light procedure call from Windows XP and Windows 2003. So there are some changes.
Yeah, it's just it's a matter of kind of, I guess, reading up on it before you just dive into the programming.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'd kind of like to sort of shift gears just a bit here, talk about a couple specific chapters in the book that sort of stuck out to me. One is actually chapter 6, which was about memory corruption in heaps, which I focus on, and for shameless plugging purposes, because that's one of the chapters that Addison Wesley gave us as an excerpt on our site. So I was just wondering if you guys might be able to give a quick summary of chapter 6, the memory corruption in heaps section of the book.
Sure. So that chapter primarily deals with how to diagnose heap corruption problems, and it is considered to be one of the tougher problems to debug due to the nature of weirdness that can happen when you have a heap corruption.
Oh, okay.
I think that a lot of reasons why developers are sort of afraid of heap corruptions is because there is a lack of information about how the Windows heap manager actually functions.
Oh, all right.
That's what the beginning part of the chapter tries to do, right? It talks about the overall architecture of the heap manager, and then drills down into the specifics, like the front-end allocator and the back-end allocator, you know, segment, heap blocks, and all that good stuff. And then the chapter sort of moves over to a more practical approach, and it basically takes a very small app that does a memory allocation and then frees that memory. That's all it does.
Oh, okay.
And it shows the reader, you know, when it's executing in the debugger, what happens, you know, internally in the Windows Heap Manager when that allocation is made and freed, so that you can get sort of the practical aspect of it as well. And then the last part of the chapter drills down into some very common causes of heap corruptions and how to debug them. So it actually has a sample application performs a heap corruption and takes the reader through that. So some examples of that are obviously, you know, heap overruns, underruns, double deletes, heap handle mismatches, and things like that.
Oh, excellent. That sounds pretty helpful there. Another one of the chapters which kind of stuck out to me just by looking at the title was something called post-mortem debugging. I was wondering maybe if you could kind of tell us what that is and how you do it and some of the best practices for that.
What exactly is post-mortem debugging? It's a little bit not very hard to explain. When you have an application and you are able to trace that application, the application is live. Like, the application really runs on a specific processor.
Oh, okay.
So you can set breakpoints, watch it hitting that breakpoint, inspect the variable values. But you don't have all the time that luxury. Sometimes you cannot just take one of the system from a customer environment and do live debugging. Perhaps the application that really runs the business. And in that case, what can you do is to just take a snapshot of that process. And that snapshot, you can load it in the debugger, and you can investigate it and debug it offline.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, we just have a copy of the system, and with that snapshot, you have some different challenges. You cannot really step into the code because the code is frozen. There's no processor involved into that.
That's right, yeah.
And in that moment, you need to use the tools, all the tools we describe, but their best capability is to really inspect the process in a frozen state.
Oh, okay.
And that process is really useful in development process. For example, if you want to debug a process, but you cannot really keep the machine, or you have limited access to the system, it is in a secure environment, or perhaps you are doing a limited beta deployment to a customer site and you just want to take a snapshot and debug it right at the spot.
Oh, okay.
And there are some other aspects of postmortem debugging. Mario?
Yeah, so the other thing that I wanted to mention there is the Windows Error Reporting Service. I'm sure you've ran an application once and seen the dreaded Dr. Watson dialog box pop up saying, do you want to send this information to Microsoft?
Mm-hmm.
Microsoft has created this Windows Error Reporting Service for developers to use in their own applications. So in order to do that, you basically go to the Windows Error Reporting website and register your company and tell the Windows Error Reporting Service which binaries that you own. And then when problems are encountered, you know, out on the customer sites with your application, the information or the snapshot that Daniel was talking about is sent up to Windows Error Reporting Service and gets attached to your company. So that allows you, as the owner of that application, to go and query for how your application is behaving sort of out in the real world.
Ah, okay.
And if there are failures, for example, then you also have the you have access to that snapshot that was sent up, and so you or, you know, your developers and whatnot can go and take that snapshot and debug it offline. And so it basically allows companies to be very proactive about monitoring their applications in the wild and reduce support costs.
The interesting aspect of that Windows Error Reporting is that it's completely free. Like, a company does not pay to participate in Windows Error Reporting feedback loop.
Oh, okay.
And Microsoft has all the hooks built in the operating system to grab the snapshots from the customer machine, transport them into the cloud, and also assign them to the customer. And And the developers just need to provide the fixes. So the entire mechanism is free for developers creating applications that are targeting customers.
Yeah. And one other thing that I wanted to add too is that, you know, if you notice that your application is crashing out there and you create a fix for it, you can submit that fix or a URL essentially to that points you to a fix. And next time a customer had that crash, that the Windows Error Reporting Service will tell the customer basically, hey, this company already has a fix for it, and it will display that URL on their machine so they can go and patch the system. So it has a very end-to-end loop that can happen.
Yeah, okay, it seems like there's a lot of different mechanisms to sort of help out the developers as they're sort of going through that process.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Interesting. I know you guys have been talking a lot about some debugging tools in this conversation, and I know you've got a significant chunk of the book devoted to it as well. Just wondering maybe if you could provide a couple sort of main sort of best practices for what to look for in a sort of debugging tools if, you know you have a particular need that you need to fulfill. What, you know, are there any sort of general rules of thumb for that, or did you just kind of go with it?
Yeah, so one of the explicit goals we had for the book was to make sure that all of these tools that we describe are freely available, right? You can just go to the respective website and download it for free and use them at will.
Oh, okay.
I think the key to figuring out what tool that you're after is making sure that you fully understand which tool is sort of best suited for the job, right? Because there are quite a few tools out there, and knowing what it is that you're after is the key point, I think.
Oh, okay.
I can say that before someone will go and invest in an expensive solution to do some troubleshooting, debugging, automatic verification tools, it's better to just read the book. And the book describes basically the same tools Microsoft engineering team uses internally.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
So, and if we are able to build an operating system and a series of applications that are fairly reliable, I would say. I think other companies can really replicate our success.
All right, that sounds like good advice. Is there anything that we didn't talk about, or any questions I didn't ask that you think are worth pointing out?
Yes, I can. I can go back to one of the questions about debugging tough code.
Oh, sure.
We experienced that at the first hand. There are some components in which the initial designer, as part of the design phase, people are not really thinking about debugging. They sort of assume a sunny day scenario, and they don't add any kind of provisions to debug that component. For example, when you're writing a communication stack, in the stack you should be able to add some correlation information, such as a user of that component should be able to track that communication.
Mm-hmm.
And we believe the developer and the architect should also be thinking about debugging from the moment they design the initial application.
Oh, that's right.
Or the initial component. And they should think how exactly that component will be debugged in by a user, and how will it be debugged on the customer environment. For example, do I need to shut down the machine just to enable some debugging tracing? That's a good experience. I'm willing to do that. There is any kind of information I need to pass to the customer before I'm able to do any kind of debugging. There are some secure environment where it's very hard to grab binary data from that environment because they are not willing to give that binary to you because they don't know what this binary contains.
Oh, okay.
For example, you understand. And I think all that requirements are true regardless of the development environment. Can be managed code, can be native code, can be Java, can be any kind of applications, can be Linux applications. The need for taking into account the debugging part as a